from? And where are we going?
Welcome to Red Ice Creations Radio. This is Henrik Palmgren, and we are coming to you from the west coast of Sweden. Thank you for tuning in. Good to have you here. Our website is redicecreations.com. News, radio, film, and much more. Thanks to everyone who sent us email and feedback on our latest short film, Longevity and the Grail, that we recently got up in our new member section. And more is on the way. Today we're talking to Michael Tessarion. Once a month we have Michael with us on the program. MichaelTessarion.com is the website that you need to take a good look at, and follow the links from there to his other sites. The new book, a fully illustrated two-volume magnum opus that rewrites the history of Ireland, Egypt and the world. The follow-up to the acclaimed book Atlantis Alien Visitation and Genetic Manipulation, Michael Tessarion's The Irish Origins of Civilization, concentrates on the fate of the world after the fall of Atlantis and the birth of evil. In the tradition of Zechariah Sitchin and Immanuel Velikovsky, Michael's investigation reveal the reason for the eradication of the Druids and highlight for the first time the terrible campaign of genocide against the ancient Irish elders, whose knowledge enriched the world's cultures. Michael exposes the true origins of the world's premier secret society and reveals the remarkable mysteries that they have been sworn to guard by sword and deception. And when I read the new book, Michael, I'm made aware of how much ancient history matters for an understanding of today's world, and the lack of historical awareness assists the power brokers to control the world.
Thank you, Henrik. That's absolutely right, especially the second sentence. I think as time goes by, people are going to become more and more aware of this. I've always been aware of it. And of course, my work is primarily following on in the tradition of many a maverick author and researcher who adamantly believed that. And nobody heard those guys at the time. But I believe that, you know, we're in an age where maybe people can grasp this point, not only the simple statement of fact that ancient history matters, or that history matters. I mean, you should have learned that in your ordinary schools, sitting in history class. I'm sure that everybody's history teacher, you know, pretty much rammed that into your head. It happens to be true. It may have been the only true thing that you learned in history class, but at least it is true. And the second part that you said there, that the lack of our consistent awareness of that is the reason why we're able to be so manipulated. There's no doubt in my mind that the person who doesn't understand what history is and how important it is not going to have a faintest idea what's happening in today's world. You know, they're just going to read the newspapers and they're going to be plugged into the consensus, but they're never going to understand it. More than that, they're actually lunatics, because by not understanding, you know, the importance of ancient history, it's almost like saying you and your children are born in some cocoon, you know, in a completely sanitized,
isolated environment.
That's right. You don't think that the blood running through your veins is the blood of your forefathers? You know, so we're not talking about dry history of some, you know, bottom shelves of a library, of an archive. You are history. You know, you are history. So when you're studying history in any shape or form, you are studying yourself. You are studying who you are. And therefore, it's the study of man. History is the study of man. But this study of man has been manipulated, as I've said so many times. The people, the power brokers of the world, don't want you to know what really happened in history, because that would empower you. So they have written and rewritten and fabricated and lied and manipulated the history of the world so that you have a very shaky of understanding of history. You have a very shaky understanding of the mysteries of evolution. And people walking around still today can't work out whether God created two people to run around naked in a Garden of Eden, and that started us off. And as that story becomes preposterous, they hand us another one called evolution, which is equally preposterous, equally mythological. So we're still running around absolutely stark naked mentally, not knowing how even the hominids, you know, who was here? How did the races get created? Then people like myself are talking about an alien visitation that changed the course of the world. Mm. So we don't come from this sterile you know, incubator. We are history, and the study of history is ourselves, but that study has been manipulated, and the study of how history has been manipulated is very, very, very fascinating. Hmm. And so for me, you know, it's the only benefit that I get from this work is that I can then bring to people's attention the work of my mentors, people whose graves are unmarked, you know, the Conor McDarries, Anna Wilkes, Commons Beaumont, Emmanuel Velikovsky. You know, to me, that is the supreme motive of maybe looking into the subject and publishing it.
And there seems to be a heightened interest also for these people's work now that you help to bring forward.
That always needs to be. That's the one thing that makes our age different. In the days of Beaumont and McDarries, you see, nobody gave any attention to this, except maybe very, very few people. So we are now in an age which is very different that way. And people are now up to their eyeballs knowing that they've been lied to. So there's more receptivity. And my work, I always say this, my work is really reserved for those people who know that they've been lied to. It's not for everybody.
Yeah.
My work is going to irritate and very, very much threaten those people who still are believing in the, you know, official consensus of everything, both psychological and sociological and historical. My work is exclusively for those who are sick and tired of the lies and who know for sure that they are now, that they've been lied to. But there are a group of people who say, well, now I want to know how I've been lied to. Now, knowing that I've been lied to, knowing that I've been deceived, knowing that the subject of history is been manipulated, I wonder what really happened.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I wonder who I really am. I wonder who my ancestors really were. And, you know, it's right now we are in this age. There seems to be a spirit abroad in the world. For instance, you know, new discoveries about the Vikings. I'm talking about ancient history, but even, you know, Christian history. Who were the Vikings? Who were the Normans? You know, we're restoring a lot of these errors that have been created. And certain myths that have been put forward by even recent groups is now coming to light. So right across the board, not just with stuff about Atlantis and Ireland and what I would call alternative history, but even in mainstream history, finds. And you better brace yourself because there's going to be more and more and more of this. And each new discovery is going to radically transform what we know about the world, what we know about the divisions and borders. Remember last time we were talking about the land bridges?
Yeah.
But again, that's ancient history. I'm talking about history that it would even be taught officially. We're going to have to tear up and burn a lot of theories because every week there's a new theory about man, a new theory about the countries and the divisions, a new revelation about the role of women in society. Like in the Incas, they've just discovered new discoveries.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that throw a whole new light on the role of women in the Inca society, you see? So every new discovery trashes that which was before. And I feel very good about that.
And it's very, so many discoveries also that it's almost difficult to, piece it all together. And I guess a big part of this work is to actually, you know, see where these pieces that now come to light, where they fit in the puzzle, so to speak.
That's right. It is a puzzle. But again, it's only a puzzle, it's only a mystery, because man has been, as we said in previous shows, colonialized. His brain has been colonialized. The great structures, I mean, of his ancestors have been misinterpreted. I mean, but anyone who's done any homework, anyone who's walked out to these ancient sites, understands that there's a mystery. But is that mystery really a mystery? Or is it a mystery because we've been told a pack of lies about what's been going on?
Mm-hmm.
But we are in an age, look at what Morris Cotterell has discovered about the Grail, right? Look what Butler and Defoe have discovered about, you know, the salt lines. Maybe later we can talk about that, the incredible matrix of ley lines that surround the world. You know, what more fascinating can you do of an evening but study who you've been and where the world has been and what has happened on this earth, you know? So right now we have the most really fortunate generation that you can imagine, because we're suddenly going to understand this mystery of the languages, this mystery of the movement of races.
Mm.
And sure, some it means that when you take on this alternative study, it might mean that you will have a complete reversal of everything you've been taught.
Mm.
It might mean that, and you're going to have to handle that.
And isn't that interesting then, because I think that underlines what you said previously, that this is about the study of yourself. and how the study of these, you know, ancient history, that this is a study of yourself, because yourself are so, you know, you react to it so strongly, so to speak. So it's a kind of an evidence right there that this is a piece of you that you're studying.
Well, I've always thought that. You know, I keep saying to people, and it sounds like a contradiction, that I'm not really that interested in history. People will go, wait a minute, you've just been talking all about history. That's right, because I know the connection between history and consciousness, history and who you are. Now, this is not taught in school. History is put before us in school as one of the most boring things you could ever want to learn, learning about the tyrants, learning about the mass murderers, learning about the psychopaths. Well, you shouldn't like it.
The kings and their names.
Yes, I want to see you hating it, because why would you want to learn all that rubbish? It's so much more interesting to find out, you know, the truth about what's been going on and why schools would be wanting to teach you that, because they're interested in, they work for Big Brother. So, of course, they're going to be insinuating what Freud called, you know, father complex into you. You're nothing. You're an underclass. You're the lower rung of the ladder here. You don't matter. Your forefathers don't matter. Your forefathers were chained. Your forefathers were slaves. Your forefathers were feudal serfs. Boy, if you didn't do what the baron said, that's it. You're going to be strung up, burned at the stake, put in the stocks. You don't matter. The politicians matter. And see, once this is insinuated into people for generation after generation in the schools, in this Dickensian way, don't you understand that then the politicians of the world, no matter who they are, think they matter?
Yeah.
They have a huge psychopathic ego complex.
Mm.
Walking on the red carpet, sitting at the walnut table, dinners galore. I mean, people, you know, in Britain will remember the wonderful, you know, show. Yes, Minister, and yes, Prime Minister. Get those out again. Get those DVDs out again. Watch it again. Go on YouTube. Go on Google. Borrow it from a pal. I don't care. Watch that again. That show shows you just how monstrous this system is. And the kings and the queens, they don't need it to be instilled. It's already instilled. That they're an overclass.
Mm.
Well, I'm not a communist. I'm against communism. But you don't have to be a communist to know that that's nonsense.
That's right.
And that no man is above another man. And if a man is superior, because I do believe there is superiority, then it's a moral superiority and possibly an intellectual superiority. But those people aren't going to lord it over you. The morally superior and the intellectually superior are midwives. Our caretakers, our elders who say, okay, I will show you where the signposts are, but I'm not going to walk for you the journey. See, the druid, the elder, the mystic, the shaman, the teacher, he says, hey, yeah, I can show you where the map is through the forest. Come on, I'll show you. And I might even teach you to read. But I'm not going to, you know, read it for you and then walk the road for you.
Mm.
I will lead you to where the knowledge is. I will lead you to where the instructions are, the instructions for life. And then it's all yours. Because I will not infringe upon your sovereignty. I will not impinge upon your free will. Well, see, what defines a sorcerer is that they do all the opposite of what I've just said. They don't teach you to read. They keep you in ignorance. They don't show you where the life map is. They have already gone down into the forest and put landmines there, so you're not going to be able to get through. All sorts of spooks, all sorts of pitfalls, all sorts of chasms, you see.
Yeah.
Like Indiana Jones in The Last Crusade. You're not going to get through those last initiations. You're not even going to get on the starting line because they've written so many lies and so many false maps and they've torn so many pages from the book of history that you'd give up. It's not Hollywood. People have given up.
Mm.
So they sit in their houses and they do whatever they do and they watch television because they feel, you know, I'm ignorant. And the elders are all gone who was to show us the way.
You were talking about that generations basically have been conditioned like this. And do you think that there potentially could be a connection with some kind of genetic memory here? Because my mind is drawn back to the idea of even how you breed, you know, dogs and stuff like this, that you domesticate an animal. Do you think that similar rules apply to a human being?
Yes, they do. And remember, what do you also have when you are breeding? You also have a thing called the purebred. You also have the pedigree, and then you got the mutts, right? In the Freemasonry, we are actually called mugs. You know the word mug? It's actually a Freemasonic term, mugger. And the Freemasons who are initiated to higher degrees know of themselves, you know, as the elites, the ones who are privy to the secrets. And the lower Freemason, and including all the rest of us, are called mugs, by the way. And in any type of breeding, you know that you have the purebreds. So when you see the royals and the queens and the kings, remember I've always said that if you see them in the public eye, they're probably not very high. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're high to you. You better believe that. But maybe they're not completely high up, you know, when it comes to the total pyramid of power. But you see, they are the purebred ones, you know, with their tails in the air. You know what I mean? And we are the ones who are like sort of, you know, the mutts, the mongrels running around. This is how they look at it. And my work is exclusively, and I really want to emphasize this point, that I would say that Jordan Maxwell and I distinguish our work very clearly by saying that our concentration is who's on the top of the pyramid. You know, because I'm constantly getting emails from people and questions that really are not pertinent to what I do. I'm not there to work out for you, you know, whether you should vote for bloody well Ron Paul or, Charlie Chaplin or whoever, you know, they put up in front of you. You know what I mean? This Muppet show, you know, you stop bothering me with nonsense like this. I don't care. You know, that's just like which talking head, you know, will we have today on the dummy?
And in the end, I guess that's must be the personal choice, if any, you know.
Well, that gives you the idea that you have some personal choice. Heckle or Jekyll, as, you know, the great Colonel Bogreitz has said, he calls us the lesser of two evils.
Yeah.
Or the evil of two lessers. I couldn't have put it more correctly. But that's okay. If you feel that this guy, this, you know, Tweedledum, can give you more, you know, street-level freedom than Tweedledee, then go ahead. I'm not against it.
Yeah.
I'm just saying, look, you know, on the street level, hey, maybe this guy can get you some justice or whatever. For God's sake, go ahead. Just don't think that he's not on a chain, on a lead. He's just permitted to give you now some a little bit more legal freedom. He's just permitting you to now be a little more green or to have a few more, you know, ecological justices because they know how to give you a little bit more so that the valve pressure won't build up so much. But don't ever forget that he's tattooed already. Don't forget that behind the lodge, they're all in, you know, together. They're all on the level, as they say in Freemasonry. They're all on the square. It's just that they sometimes do realize that people are going buck mad with this mediocrity and with the open injustices. So as your injustices increase, you know that people are going to become more disgruntled. So let's pacify them. And sometimes we throw out, you know, an individual, I'm not going to name any names, but a person who may appear to be, you know, a good brother, a little brother instead of a big brother. But you see, again, as I said, my interest is not so much focused there. It's focused really on that 14th level of the pyramid. Who is it that operates from the top of the pyramid? Can we get a profile on them? Can we maybe put together a, you know, forensic composite of these people? You know, may not be 100% accurate, but we got to start somewhere. Because all these poxy little small revolutions on the bottom level, you know, how many of those have we had in the last couple of centuries? Hundreds. Has anything really changed?
Not really.
A few social things may change. In fact, if you allow me, I'd like to read a small caption from the Irish Origins book.
Please go ahead.
It's not long. It says, I think this is, I can't remember what chapter it's from, but it says that the power elites and their minions who apparently believe the world to be their personal playpen have a great deal to lose should the underclasses, that's the ordinary men and women of the world, learn about the subtle nature of the psychic and social control that operates all around them and which is hidden in plain sight. However, the task of revealers is made considerably more difficult due to the consensus trance and the knee-jerk fear reactions that automatically inhibit a mutilated and conditioned mind. The servants of truth know, from experience, how few friends are won, if and when they should endeavor to expose the dirty little secrets of religion's upper echelons. Nevertheless, a servant of truth is not permanently daunted by the discomfort caused by the presence and the proximity of truth. The servant of truth is aware that it is easier to cut oneself with a blunt knife rather than with a sharp one, and that the price of ignorance is ultimately far greater than the price paid for knowledge. The servant of truth knows that freedom is never free, and that silence is most definitely consent. He comes to realize that on the great board game of life, if he fatally chooses not to occupy the white squares of knowledge, he will be manipulated by those who will. It points this out that, you know, because I get a lot of emails and communiques, I'm always corresponding, always talking to people who are, first of all, very pessimistic because they feel very alone and cut off and isolated when they start to share this with their families and so on. And my response is always the same. Forget about that. This message is much bigger than the local yokel level. It's a message that's for the global audience that is receptive. Don't beat your head against a wall and then tell me that you have a headache, right? You know, this is inevitable. And try to realize that there's a greater theme going on here. And that is that you're serving truth. You're not really serving people. You're serving truth itself.
And the truth wants to get out. Do you think that?
Yes, the truth always will want to get out. And it's the only reason why it doesn't get out is because of that big weight that we've been talking about. You see, that's imposed upon us. These lies that are being told and the efforts to resist the natural flow of truth. Truth is a naturally flowing thing.
Okay, so that also might be a reason why the lie, so to speak, and the conspiracy around to suppress all this knowledge, that this is something that constantly has to be hammered in, so to speak. This is something that is recurring, while truth, in a way, as you say, it surfaces, and once it's out, it's out. You can't stop it, basically.
Well, you see, you have to, it's like stopping and smell the roses. And we have a chance to do that again. Truth can flower, but if you don't want to taste the fruit, if you don't want to smell the aroma, then okay, so what? You see, so this is where the real human being has to continue his studies. He's got to already understand that he's being lied to, manipulated, and deceived. And as you said in the introduction, that deception is, you know, there's people sworn to the job of deceiving us. And they're going to cut truth seekers down either by the sword, as they've done in the past, or by, you know, veils and veils and veils of deception. So it's not an easy task. And when people start by learning a bit of this and then going and starting talking to people and, you know, they get this very negative reaction. Realize that, you know, well, I can't tell them to realize it or not, but that's that point of decision then when you go, okay, well, I'll just crawl back into the kennel with everybody else because this is a bit of a pain. Or you can choose to not bother with anybody else and continue the subject, you know, silently, quietly, in your own garret. You know, people around you, you know, don't need to know what you're doing. What does it matter to them what you're doing? You're educating yourself. You're finding out the mysteries of life. It doesn't necessarily mean that they should know what you're doing. Let them get on with whatever rubbish they're involved in and carry on with your sacred work. First of all, you're doing sacred work when you're studying alternative history. You are in the occult.
And it's a personal journey.
And it's a personal journey. And, you know, many times it's a spiritual journey, so there really is no room for two people on the road. You know, get where you're going first. Awaken yourself first, and then turn around and, you know, create a blog or a website or a radio show or a movie or a documentary or write a script, you know, or write a book or whatever, or do a couple of public talks to a wider audience, you see. There's all sorts of avenues for you. We're in a MySpace generation now. We're in a Google and YouTube generation. So there's the avenues there for you. But for goodness sake, first find out what's going on. Do your own research. Don't hesitate. And don't get put off just because, you know, people who are never going to get the truth start, you know, arguing with you or whatever. You will have resistance even in official subject matter. What do you expect when you're doing this kind of work?
Yeah, exactly, because that's one idea that I think many people spend perhaps too much time on, the fact that they are bickering and fighting against themselves almost more than focusing on you know, continuing their own research or their own work and just, you know, letting their research lead them towards the path or avenues that they're going, basically. And
that's right. And I understand why. This is a very interesting subject. It's highly inspiring. When you find out a few anecdotes, you know, say if you're reading Jim Mars or Jordan Maxwell, you know, or Anthony Hilder or any of these books on the Knights Templar, you know, how would you not want to run down and grab your friend, you see, and grab your friend and go, my God, look what I've discovered. I'm not arguing that this thing is not tremendously inspiring. It is the most inspiring thing. But we have to realize that this is a spiritual journey, and you, as some sort of, you know, Luke Skywalker type character, you know, is just not going to be, you know, sitting down to dinner at the table of the uncles and aunt, you know, in the local village, and you're going to turn them all on by this. It's not going to happen. It doesn't mean that you don't have brothers and sisters of light and of truth in the world. You do, but you have to not. Let's put it this way. Let's put it really in like a sort of an Ayn Rand context. Have no expectations. Do what you do for yourself, not for anyone else. And when you do the thing utterly for yourself, when you are convinced that this is your passion and this is what you're doing, the road will open up to the next step. You know, but believe me, it is a very fascinating subject, and I think that because people think it's fascinating, and it's obvious that you would want to share this with other people. But you know, they're just not there. They're just not listening, and that's why we have to understand that there is a lot of resistance on this road. But as the resistance increases, what you also have to understand, it's like that metaphor we gave of the man climbing the mountain. The resistance increases as you rise, but your vista, your perspective, your understanding of what is all around you increases. And just, you know, don't get hindered by the fact that lots of other people couldn't care less about this. Mm. Note it, study it, find out why, you know, people have this much resistance to truth. Make that part of your study.
So one of the things that we're going to talk a little bit about here today is, of course, ancient geometry and also the salt lines. Where do you want to begin?
Well, I got a great deal of faith that the new scientific discoveries, as I said, there's been new revelations about the Cretans and Minoans, you know, even Armenia has an incredibly ancient society, which I believe was very much connected to the Druids.
Mm-hmm.
As slowly the lid starts coming off the royal families and the royalty of the world and these people who've ruled us for centuries, I have an enormous belief, and again, my work focuses, as I said, on the top of the pyramid, who are their real elites, you know, and what kind of knowledge have they been using to manipulate us. Let's get a profile on who these guys are. As we move down through the years, more and more revelations are going to come. Some of these revelations will be even from insiders, people who have a sea change within their own consciousness, mm-hmm, who technically have been insiders. They may have been part of this dynastic matrix of control.
And we even have a few of those today.
We do. And we have more that we don't know about, but they work through the movies.
Mm-hmm,
you know,
mm-hmm.
Who do you think made National Treasure, you see, or, you know, even the Da Vinci Code, et cetera, you know?
Mm.
Who's putting out these films and why? The Matrix and all of these kinds of things. So we have questions about that. Is someone blowing the whistle from within with some of this kind of thing, you know? Who are these John Rottenberries, you know, and Rod Serlings? I mean, are they just storytellers, or is there something deeper going on? That's an open question. But as time goes by, we're going to understand more and more of what has been hidden from us. And one of the most amazing things that the absolute elites have made use of is sacred geometry. And also geomancy, which is sacred geometry as applied to the earth itself. Now, remember we were talking, mm-hmm. you opened with the introduction saying that a lack of understanding as to how important history is contributes to their control directly.
Mm-hmm.
It's a simple equation.
Exactly.
The less understanding you have about your own history equals your level of subservience and control. How do you prove that? How do you prove that these ancient royal families and dynasties literally did work with great power? I mean, prove it is what the audience will say. Well, last time we talked about the existence of the land bridges, which radically changed what we know about Britain and the world. And as time is going by, this has been discovered by the top geologists. These are people who don't know or care about Atlantis or don't care about the material we'd be talking about. But they certainly have proven that the lands of Britain and Ireland and France and Scandinavia, you know, were connected at one time.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe as the further you go back, the more they're connected by these lost land bridges and so
exactly,
on.
Exactly. Yeah.
And that unimaginable catastrophes arose to destroy it. Tying into this, I think, is this fascinating discovery of specifically two groups, the Cistercian monks and their military branch called the Knights Templar.
Mm-hmm.
They positioned their houses, and this happened wherever they lived, not just their monasteries, but their palaces, their cities, their houses, their institutes, their religious centers, are all positioned specifically on these unseen energy vortexes and lines that sometimes are called the salt lines, but are more historically known as the great ley lines, you see, or synchronic lines. And I've talked about this in my DVDs and shown just how important this is. And everyone knows that, you know, if you're living in a village somewhere and you've taken a walk or you've taken your dog out and you've gone up towards where the church is positioned, you see your local church, and you've looked around at the street names and you've maybe marveled at how your city or town was laid out, and that some of the streets seem to align with distant hills or distant valleys, you see. This is a thing that you can go out and observe yourself and get interested in this idea of why are the churches positioned in certain ways? Why are a lot of them on mounds? What was on this mound prior to when this church was there?
Mm-hmm,
all these
yeah.
kinds of things.
Yeah.
But when you take it up to the next level and the next level, then you start getting into mysteries like the one at René-le-Château, where it turns out that, you know, the local people there, these local Masonically connected guys, Templar-funded priests, started literally, you know, following along from this, meaning that they emulated the old Templar habit of aligning things through sacred geometry. You know, whether you believe it was to the star Venus, geometry, you know, to Venus, or whether it's solar geometry. It's basically zodiacal geometry.
Yeah.
You know, to cut a long story short, a lot of this geometry goes back to the zodiac and to the favorite signs of the zodiac and whatnot.
Exactly. And, you know, Berenger Saunier, the guy built the Rensselaer Chateau, I mean, he apparently got a lot of money again from someone to rebuild that church and all of that. So
that's right.
There's an interest there, you know.
Hasn't it just recently, there's some war memorial that's just been put up within the last few weeks, the British Royal Family?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
What was that? You sent me that.
Amazing. A big circle. That was from the Second World War memorial, I think. And they had one. A big obelisk, I think, either inside the circle or just outside, and big walls, a circle, basically.
It might have been outside, because that's the traditional way that the Irish sites are done. But wasn't there also incorporated into, not only was it a round circle, I mean, like the pagan, here we are, Christian, these royals are meant to be Christian, but then they go and celebrate at a great modern temple that's designed exactly like the ancient Irish temples. But wasn't there also a pyramidical design in there, an obelisk or some sort of thing? I mean, it incorporated the Irish symbolism, but it also incorporated the we can put the link up anyway, for people to check this out again. But look the Millennium Dome, positioned close to Greenwich. You know, and as we said, word roots, you take the word root Greenwich and you find it doesn't mean green itch. Greana in Celtic or Irish meant sun place. So it's the place of the sun. Well, of course, they took the time from there.
The meridian, yeah.
Right. So these people are preoccupied with this, the risings and the settings of the sun, the stations of the sun, the 12 signs of the zodiac, the 13th sign. Let's start waking up. But there's a lot of symbolism here in the numbers and the designs of these places. And you're talking about these guys having power over you. If they're able to put their houses, their colleges, their schools, their homes on very powerful positions of the earth, not only are they empowered by that, but you are automatically disempowered because you are on the geopathic, what's called geopathic. Look up that word. You know, we'll create a link.
You're talking about cities here now.
Yeah, cities, towns, prisons. How does a place become geopathic? How do you run around, you know, like a headless chicken, confused, poverty-stricken, lost, violent, angry, you know, in conflict? There's a whole matrix going on here. There's a game. There's an entire study of civic design that we need to understand about the difference between the geometry of the square and the circle. You know, I go into this in the Atlantis DVD. No, it's the Subversive Use of Sacred Symbolism DVD about why cities are designed in squares as opposed to circles as it was in ancient times, you see. You know, the ancient Vikings used to have the long houses. You know, very great emphasis on the way that these houses in ancient times were designed, and churches are also designed based on the human body, like the Temple of Solomon was based on the design basically of the human body, you know, the proportions of the phi ratio.
And this is something that can it heal your body? Is this the just from an, you know, energetical level? This is something that appeals to your body, to your DNA, to your, you know, energetic body, basically.
Absolutely. Right down to the bed you sleep in, the rooms you live in. You see, it really, if a person wants to think about it, it's like feng shui for your house, but on a global level. It's like acupuncture for your body, but on the global level. So where those flags are positioned, where those buildings are, where those obelisks are, where those state edifices are, where those statues are positioned, where the fountains are placed, every part of it is part of this feng shui of the earth. And it is part of the control mechanism that's used on us. But I want to emphasize in this program just how far back this knowledge goes. And also want to emphasize that this knowledge is not invented by the Templars who used it.
Yeah, you know? Exactly. I mean, the obvious question here is how the heck, to begin with, how the heck do you detect something like this? How do you pick up on this, you know?
Well, let me read a quote from my book. It's taken from two gentlemen who wrote extensively on this, Alan Butler and Stephen Defoe. And their books, we'll make sure that there's links for people to check this out. But they talk about these, and they talk about the discovery of these incredible lines. And it says here that the late Professor Alexander Thom an engineer for Oxford University, worked tirelessly for many decades, carefully surveying and measuring the many megalithic standing stones, stone circles and other alignments left on the landscape of Britain and parts of France since truly ancient times. Right? So this Professor Tom is a leading genius, one of the first to go out and start remeasuring the ancient sites.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Very important figure, because he's one of the people that will tell you, again, revising history. No, guys, they weren't a bunch of skin-wearing, bone-chucking idiots, which is what has been believed for mm-hmm. centuries, and that's what the royals and the intelligentsia would love you to believe.
Yeah,
those
yeah.
are just primitive, shivering, you know, people. People like Alexander Thom and other scholars refute this. And they go on to say that one important fact emerged as a result of his tireless efforts. Almost every monument dating from about 3,500 years B.C. until about 1,500 years B.C. had been built using the same basic linear measurement.
Hmm.
This, Professor Thom discovered, was about 82 centimeters in length, and he called it the megalithic yard.
Okay.
We'll have a link to that.
Hmm. That's interesting. Is there any connection between that and what we know as the cubit, you know, the royal cubit?
There is. There is the megalithic yard was also, what you're talking about is a measurement used by the Egyptians, but it turns out that the Egyptians, according to the scholars, also used this megalithic yard that was mm-hmm. that was used in the West. So this very much backs up my theory. That's why I'm incorporating the work of Allen and Butler and Defoe in my work, is because it's more evidence to show that what was happening in East, in Egypt, in the Levant, was based upon what was happening in Ireland
and
the West.
Yeah.
Let me give you a stronger example of what I mean. You tell me why it is that the city of Rome and many other cities in Europe, but the city of Rome are exactly perfectly aligned linearly to the sun windows of Newgrange ancient monument in Ireland, on the west coast of Ireland.
Really? Is yes, that so?
That's right. Now, Sheesh. What I'm telling you is this, that this megalithic site in Ireland is the oldest megalith in the world. It's a sun temple, you know, created by the ancient Celts. It goes back thousands and thousands of years B.C. It's a very remarkable place, and people can see photographs of it on my website. But it has a little sun door, a little window that's about 7 feet wide. Very, very small. 7 feet, that's all. Now, can you explain to me why the city of Rome, that was built centuries after, you know, Newgrange was built, is perfectly aligned with that sun door? So it's not back to front. The Celts didn't, or the Irish didn't build Newgrange to face Rome.
Mm-hmm.
No, 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 no. Something infinitely more interesting happened.
The other way around.
Yeah. Tara, which is not far from Newgrange, is known to be on seven hills or seven barriers or boundaries, it was called.
Mm-hmm.
So the number seven, Tara is surrounded by seven boundaries or fences mm-hmm. in ancient times. Yeah. Rome is built on the
seven hills.
Right.
Isn't it Jerusalem? The seven hills or mounts
right.
or whatever.
And the number seven is in the, you know, stars that aligned to the pyramid. Mm. The pyramid was built, you know.
So we can see that these cities here, that, again, I mean, especially Jerusalem today, the significance, again, there's fighting, so much fighting in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a connection here, again, between Rome, Jerusalem, and going back to Ireland again.
Going back to Tara. In the word roots as well. The word Tara itself turns up in Egypt. It was a famous name in as far away as Tibet. But also you'll notice that during the so-called political shenanigans that are happening in the Holy Land, you'll suddenly see this anecdote in the news about how they've moved the Temple Mount.
Mm.
Or a temple is taken down and rebuilt or moved over there. You know, have you ever heard about this? The boundary lines. And we just think nothing of it. Well, you know, what's that all about? That you suddenly take a building down from here and you move it over there?
I think they did that in Athens very recently, if I remember correctly. They moved some temple.
That's right. It happens a lot, and you need to pay attention to this, because this is this geomancy that we're talking about in effect. Like we talked about in previous show, how come there's 13 obelisks in Rome? These are Egyptian obelisks. How come there's 13 in Rome out of the 21 in the world?
Mm.
And the rest are in London or God knows where, you know? So, and what am I talking about? In Washington?
Of course.
You see what I mean? So the moving of these stones, the re-erecting, the enormous ritual that goes into a lot of this empowers these people. And as these... Defoe and Butler have discovered, it's a very ancient thing. The quote goes on to say, when applied to the geometry and mathematics discovered in Crete, because Crete is the focus, you see, of Defoe and Butler's work as well. When applied to the geometry and mathematics discovered in Crete, it became obvious that the megalithic yard was part of a mathematical worldview that had perpetrated across a vast period of time and throughout large areas of Europe. With the megalithic yard and the geometry of which it was an intrinsic part, the ancient peoples of Britain and locations much further afield must have had an astonishing knowledge of the true dimensions of the earth upon which they lived.
Ah.
Okay?
So, yeah.
Now, let me hammer home the idea of that this is knowledge inherited from the West. That's why it's in my book. In other words, the Irish connection. The Celts, they use the word Celt, I use the word Irish. Let's not get into the reasons why right now, but they mean the Irish.
We've talked about
Celts,
that, the difference between Celtic and Druid.
It's important, yeah.
Yeah.
But basically for this quote, he means the Western Irish. The Celts, probably moving into Britain after about 500 BC, had shown a great reverence for the salt lines and had placed many shrines and sacred sites upon them. This had also been true of the Romans and later the Anglo-Saxons. See how the knowledge carries down? Now, it carries down through the royal lines. It doesn't carry down through our families.
That's right.
They're in ignorance, remember. They're slaves. The most surprising aspect to the salt line research lay in the fact that it soon became obvious that the run of the lines, although actually invisible upon the ground, had retained a mystical significance for countless centuries after those creating the lines had ceased to exist. When you get into their work, you just suddenly discover that they're basically saying that the oldest of these lines and the most precise of these lines was in the British Isles. And that it transmuted from there, it continued from there into France, and the Templars picked up on it, you see, and continued the process. And they discovered that all the very most important Cistercian monasteries, because when you read about the Knights Templar, you have to realize that there was two organizations that made up the Templars. And one was called the Lamb, and the other was called the Tiger. This is how they kind of did it. The Lambs are the Cistercian monks in their monkish robes, living in their monasteries, nonviolent. Right?
Okay.
They're the intelligentsia.
Yeah.
They are the ideologue. They are the
administrators.
Administrative, yes. But they sit sort of meditating and reading the ancient chronicles and hoarding all this stolen druidic knowledge from Ireland, you see. And then you have the military branch, the guys who are going to go out and conquer the world. These are the Knights Templars as we know them. So there's two branches. And what is most important to emphasize is this. It is now coming to light that the Knights Templar and the Cistercians, the first Cistercian monasteries were opened in Ireland, by the way.
Really?
Yeah. But the Cistercians and the Templars and many nobles of France and Europe, because that's who the nobles were all Templars. We're talking Merovingian dynasty here. We're talking Carolingian dynasty here. These nobles of France, of Burgundy, of Champagne, of Troyes, and of Troyes in France, and also of Lorraine. And we're talking the Bourbon dynasty here. We're talking the Angevins. We're talking the Savoys. We're talking about the House of Lorraine. We're talking about dynasties that would later become the Stuarts and the Plantagenets of England. We're talking about the Guise family. These individuals who were Templar families, they were all Cistercians, which was a Catholic dynasty. What has been discovered is that this Catholic Cistercian monastic dynasty were tutored by shadowy figures from a group known as the Chaldean monks of Ireland, who technically were under Vatican control, but who were steeped in ancient Druidism. In fact, these Chaldean monks, that's C-U-L-D, and we'll put up a link for people, the Chaldee monks were people who had been seduced very much by the old ancient traditions of Ireland. And so they had been frowned upon by Latin Catholics because they a little bit were too much involved in the old Celtic Druidic stuff.
They began to merge almost.
They began to well, they didn't merge so much as what they had stolen that knowledge.
Took over that.
Yes, because the people we're talking about, remember, these are no godly people. These are people who had annihilated the Druids. You know, people, when they follow my book, they'll see how exactly how this process took place. We're jumping a little bit ahead here, but we're doing that because we want to isolate and highlight this most interesting fact regarding the first Catholic monastic orders in Ireland, who are known technically as the Chaldean monks. These Chaldeans, although they suppressed Druidism, they were highly interested in it. They didn't let this be known, but they were really licking their lips over this. They sat up late at night reading the ancient books and learning about the people they had destroyed. The bardic traditions, you see, the lineages of the kings, all the stuff that I go into.
Mm.
Well, these boys were now the new archivists of it. You tell me they're not going to open those treasure troves and dig around in there?
Of course they're.
With their feet up and smoking their big cigars?
Yeah, I never really, believed, I guess, that idea that a lot of the ancient books and so forth actually was burned, like what happened in South America and so forth. I think a lot of this knowledge was, taken and stored away, basically, and we're told that they were burned and all gone mm-hmm. by now, you know.
We're giving you the proof right now. How could the salt line knowledge, which was not invented by the Templars, they arrive in the 11th century A.D., Mm. The salt lines are 4,000 B.C. Mm. or more.
Mm.
I believe they go way back. You know, they go back to the Indus Valley. They go back to the Druids. The Druids and the people of the Indus Valley were connected, you see. So these things are ancient. How did they learn this knowledge? And remember, as Christians, you're not meant to learn this knowledge.
Yeah, it's magic, evil.
That's right. So here we have the proof, positive. Not only did they know about the dimensions of the earth which they inherited, but they started to incorporate the same pagan ideas that they, on a paper, forbade you and your forefathers and your descendants to study.
Mm.
This is how they get empowered. Because, as we all say it again, and this is written in blood, you know, let's put it up in neon lights in Times Square. Ancient history matters. Ancient history explains what is happening in today's world.
Mm.
If you don't want to know what's going on in today's world, never study history.
Mm.
Ignore it. If you do want to know what's going on in today's world, start getting into ancient history, or let's say the alternative history, because then you're going to find the answers. So these power elites, what are we talking about here? It's already established in the world by dozens of authors, hundreds of authors, that the Templars, Knights Templar, the Freemasons, the Order of Malta, the Sovereign Order of the Knights of Malta, the Hospitallers, right? The Order of Zion.
Mm.
And how many more can we add? That these endless secret societies worked for royalty, are highly empowered with some unknown occult knowledge, and basically is controlling the banks, controlling the charities, controlling the political systems of the world. If you don't believe it, just study the symbolism on these political orgs.
Hmm.
Then what are we finding? As in the last lot of years, we're discovering that these people were educated by monks who were privy to the Druidic knowledge of ancient Ireland.
Hmm.
And that that Bernard de Clairvaux, you see, and his mentors, or Robert de Molesme, you see, and Hugh de Payens, and Godefroy de Bouillon, whose names and I hope people are starting to get familiar with, you see.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
People who were involved in the First Crusade.
Yes.
Or perhaps even William I, the Conqueror, William the Conqueror of England, or Richard the Mad, Lionheart, crazed out psychopath that he was, the Plantagenet kings, that Edward I, the Hammer of the Scots, the Sinclair family, like, you know, where does it stop?
Mm.
That St. John's Wood and most of the boroughs of London, there's 28 of them, by the way, relating to the 28 dimensions of the moon, that the very boroughs of London are based on the lunar cycle.
Really?
Oh, let's not even start with that. I mean, we don't want to start the program on all the examples here. We'll be here for, you know, till next week.
Yeah.
But a person who's made a study of this, who's looked into the names of the provinces, why was Ireland divided into five provinces? Was that to do with consciousness, perhaps? Is there a special reason why the number five, you know, turned up in all of this?
Very interesting.
You see, the five provinces, four around a central one. What's going on here?
Mm-hmm.
You know, or these, as I say, these geomantic. But let's just keep it purely scientific. Let's not, you know, go into too many tangents. Let's keep it specific to measurement and this whole idea that measurements, distinct measurements based on the phi ratio, based on the cubit, based on the megalithic yard, were used worldwide, but they originated in the West.
Mm.
The great scholar Anthony West, right? This is John Anthony West, Egyptologist, swears blind. You can see it in programs he's made, in the series of programs that he made on Egypt. And we can link to those for people. Swears blind that the foundations of the pyramid, when you go down to the bottom strata of the pyramid, is Irish by design.
Hmm.
That it the only place that it actually looks like, it's not common of Egyptian people to build like that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But it looks very much like the megaliths of Ireland and England.
Okay, that's right? Very interesting.
I wonder if he knows what the power of what he's saying.
Hmm.
To me, it's no problem. Of course it was. That was the disciples of Horus, the Shamsu Hor. There isn't a single statue in existence, no matter how far you go back in the millennia, that doesn't show Horus with blue eyes, Henrik.
Hmm. That's interesting.
And many of his titles was the Westerner, the god of the West.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Same with Anubis and many of the gods. They have Western symbols tied into their
word roots.
Oh, yeah, that's
right. Exactly. The Anubis from the West, who, by the way, traveled down the Thames recently, a return maybe to the land of the old.
Exactly. These are rituals. You know, people by now should realize that when you see a boat floating down the Thames with the Egyptian god Anubis on it on the Thames River, what does that word mean? Why did it happen on that particular month? What's symbolic about those dates?
Yeah.
Why on earth would the god of the dead, you see? Is it because an old age is closing? See, Apuat, right, or Anubis, his real name, was meant the opener of the ways, the opener of the gates. The river represents the Milky Way.
Yeah, that's
opening
right.
The gate, the what? Opening the zodiacal gate to a new zodiacal age. The Milky Way cuts from Taurus and Gemini through to Sagittarius and Scorpio through the 13th sign. Okay, so the number 13 turns up in this ritual. Anubis turns up in this ritual. The mystery of the Minotaur, where the hero goes into the underworld, you know? Well, that's another Milky Way river of Styx symbolism. Because Mina is the ending of the word of Gemini, and Tor is the beginning of the word of Taurus.
Minotaur.
So a Minotaur,
yeah.
Right, is a code word in Greece, not very well hidden, but hidden well enough so that most people wouldn't notice it, to represent the division between the signs of Gemini, right? Gemini, and Taurus. It's the same thing they use with a car, the Mini. It's only for a two-seater car, right? Mini, Gemini, it's the twins. The car Mini is really should be called the Gemini or Gemini because it's only two-seater for two people.
Yeah.
Right? They're using all the symbolism on you all the time. But this great river that Anubis, the god of the opener of the way, he can't open the way without closing a previous way. He doesn't open a new gate without closing the old gate. The Vatican symbol is two keys, isn't it? Two crossed keys.
That's right.
You close one gate, you open another gate. These are the ministers of the gates. Did you know that the very word Pope means bridge, pontifex.
Or door, even.
Or doorway, yeah. Right? And the word cardinal.
The hinges.
Is the hinges, yeah. Means the hinges of the door.
That's right.
So these are door portal openers, way openers. The Pope did the millennial address to the Jews, remember, when he said, oh, we're all sorry. Remember that? That was, again, at the door of Pisces, just before the Aries came, back a few years ago. When, you know, so most Vatican things are done at very specific times. So, yes, when you see these rituals, and there's going to be many, people need to brace themselves because there's going to be so many more. Because things are moving now, and you're not going to have a clue what it means unless you're very, very familiar with the occult story behind a lot of what these people do.
So you think that these rituals, and especially, again, the gate or even the stargate, a lot of these themes are recurring, and a lot of people are looking into this, that this the specifics of it, or the general outline is that this is astrological in you know, it's in its fundamentals, that this has to do with a closing of one age and the opening of a new, basically.
That's right. And they're going to do it whether, you know, we like it or not. In the DVD on astrotheology, I went into a lot of this to show exactly what it means when you're dealing with the age of Aquarius and the change over to the age of Pisces, and how symbolism needs to change, how the status quo often changes, how many of the social idioms that we know change. And often a lot of them are done consciously, conspicuously. But my major concern, you see, is that, look, these people inherited their knowledge from the ancient Irish Druids. How come they don't allow us direct access to that?
Yeah, they want to say that they invented it, of course.
That's
they
right.
Are there, or
and they're using it exclusively. See, it's not, God love them, I'm not envious, let them use it. But let us use it too. We have to redress the power balance in the world. And people go, how are we going to get rid of these evil ones? Oh, lament, woe is me. You get, as Jordan Maxwell has said so many times, you balance out the problem. You restore your own power by using the same powers they use. Don't hope we can grasp this point. They are empowered because they've used this knowledge. They're empowered because, as you say, they've messed with our DNA. They've got us to be divided schizoid beings. We deal with that by using the same arcane knowledge in the same way. And we use it more sacredly than they do. We go back to the traditions of the past. Because you can believe that there will never be change in this world until we do.
That's right. And again, then, so, I mean, if you want to know who is at the top of that pyramid and the 14th step, as you mentioned, you need to go into history here.
What is a bloody pyramid? How is that made?
Yeah.
How are all the structures made? Look at these megalithic sites. Half the people of the world, they don't even know how the stone was lifted. There's not a crane in existence that can lift the Baalbek stone.
No.
You know, I mean, we've got to realize that the you know, talking Merovingians, Dagobert the First spent a lot of time in Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
Can we get around this idea? Bernard de Clairvaux. The people who sat down invented bloody crusades, man, who tutored the noble families of Europe, spent time studying the ancient mysteries of the Druids that they had stolen and appropriated.
Mm.
I call them Atenists, but let's not get into that. These solar cult worshippers that we know as Templars and Freemasons and what have you are empowered in their lodges by secret arcane knowledge that I believe, as a teacher, should be shared, should be available, let's say, to the all of the people of the world, those who are hungry for it.
Mm.
And I believe that if there's going to be a close a door of our own and open another one into the idea that we also now need to be initiated, not just a small clique of manipulating Luciferians, but the whole world. The people who are really, you know, what I would call self-initiated,
mm.
who are priests and priestesses in their own right, need to use this. Because these kings sat at the feet of the Chaldean monks, who had already sat at the feet of the Druidic knowledge and appropriated it.
Mm-hmm.
So when you hear, you know, Butler and Defoe wondering, oh my goodness, how did this all happen? Wasn't it a great thing that the Knights Templars wanted to embody the feminine principle, you know, of Mary?
Mm-hmm.
Three bloody cheers. You know, okay, is that as far as you've got? You know, or in the Da Vinci Code, the big mystery, is that just they want to incorporate, the, you know, the Holy Mother?
Mm.
Where did those ideas come from? Mm. It wasn't just segmented to that. It wasn't just, oh, let's just take this little piece of the ancient tradition. These were people who were too imbued with the entire pagan tradition. Until Big Daddy from Vatican came and wrapped their fingers, you see, and slaughtered them, slaughtered their own people.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The Chaldeans were annihilated, as the Templars, as you know, were, right? The Templars were annihilated by their own people.
Yeah, that's right.
Right. Did you know that the real reason for that is because the Templars were going, they were playing hooky too much from the main curriculum?
Mm-hmm.
They were so infatuated, so interested in the previous, that they stopped doing the homework for the Pope.
Hmm.
And the Pope, knowing what this would lead to, is maybe what you would call AWOL. How do you know that then these noble families don't turn on you and maybe completely go back?
Hmm.
We got to keep them under control. We can't have these people bunking school and causing dissension in the ranks.
Hmm.
We'll lose control. So in exactly the same way as they destroyed the Amonists of Egypt, in exactly the same way that they destroyed the Druids of Ireland, they turned on their own people.
Mm.
And people who've studied officially in the modern era of history, that they know that the Chaldean monks of Ireland was suppressed. This is commonly known in Ireland, at least this part of history is known, because it technically falls under the Christian era, you see. And we know, of course, everybody knows now that the Templars were suppressed and their Grand Masters, you know, taken out. That was just a sign. That was just a symbol saying, we know you're one of us. We know we don't really have that much against you. But, you know, we're going to do a Kennedy on you here. I got to blow your brains out. We got to burn you at the stake because you have gone too far.
Hmm.
You've done the unthinkable. You have broken the code.
Hmm.
And if people doubt how powerful these codes are, just go online and watch the Brotherhood of the Bell. You know, these whistleblowing movies that show you just how important obedience is.
Oh, yeah.
And that they will absolutely sacrifice you. Because remember, they don't think of it as killing you or murdering you. You're being sacrificed. And there's a big difference between ritual sacrifice of one of your own gang, which has happened many times in history, and just blowing their heads off or murdering them. Like, you know, getting rid of a Malcolm X.
Mm.
That's different. That's killing a mug.
Mm.
Somebody who dares to stand up in the face, you see, and say, the hell with you and your system.
Mm.
Killing one of their own people is a ritual. That's very different. It's very, very, very different game is being played there, the ritual death.
One thing I want to ask you here is, do you think that some of this knowledge or parts of it then potentially could have been lost, meaning that the knowledge that they have now and operating from actually only is partial, it isn't complete or whole, so to speak. So what they're doing now basically is a negative vibe in this. It becomes more black magic than white magic.
Remember we talked in this interview about the future of mankind? We talked about the technological world.
Yeah.
This whole post-human world.
Post-human world, yes.
And we talked about that, yes, the ritual does continue and it does get blacker because what's really happening is that they're committing slow suicide. The human is committing slow suicide. The human part of us is meant to be phased out and probably replaced by a sort of a technological
Oh yeah.
Android type, you see, being. They think it's what human beings is going to evolve into.
Mm, yeah.
So it's not that they don't have full access to the
knowledge.
The knowledge, the but you might not. It's like a game. It's like a Monopoly, or you know, it's like a jigsaw. You may not have access to all. You may not take. You have access to all the pieces, but you may not need the pieces at a certain time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So they're just left in the box. So as time progresses, they start using all those pieces that maybe haven't been used for centuries. Now is the time to plug them in.
Mm.
Now is the time to use those secret keys, because they are. There's always to be refreshing this. There's always to be moving out. All that matters, Henrik, is the agenda, not the individuals. When these people are sworn into their lodges, they're sworn to immolate, that means to burn up, their own personal identity.
Mm-hmm.
Your identity doesn't matter. You're a degree. Your degree matters. Of course, they couch all of this in beautiful-sounding language like the brothers.
Mm-hmm.
It's not you, it's the brotherhood. It's all of us together. We're community. I throw up at all this stuff, and they're starting to use it now in the political world. You and your community
sure.
are meaningless.
Sure.
But that's just a nice, easy way to say you don't matter. It's the brotherhood, it's the community, it's the family, it's the people, it's the state, it's the nation. Here's your flag. Well, it's no difference in the degrees of Freemason. Probably it's even more so. It's like the army. Your own particular identity, you see, is meaningless. It's all about how much you've conformed, how much you're facing the plan. The plan is what is important. The keepers of the royal secret. What is the royal secret? So the thing is that these individuals are involved. And we have to understand that these old Merovingians, these old Carolingians, you know, and they say they came from the Franks and the Sicambrians, you know, these are exactly the same people as the Stuarts and the Windsors of today, you know, and the Saxe-Coburgs, Gothas, you see, and all the royals and many of their henchmen. And I am convinced that the Rhodes Scholars, you see, in the Fabian Society and your so-called neocons, I mean, the names change every decade, man. The face is the same.
That's right. Right?
Zionists, politicians. Every one of these people serve these dynastic powers. They're just henchmen. The venture capitalists who fund, you know, huge companies like the Silicon Valley companies that you just think appeared out of the blue yesterday, you know, or the genetics, the whole, like you've already done wonderful work yourself exposing this whole cult of the new genome projects and, the, you know, the cults that they're seeded with the same Templar symbols of the Grail.
That's right.
And the cross and the red cross, you know, and the whole Methuselistic, you know, living forever symbolism, the, taking huge bites out of what? The Bible symbolism, taking huge bites out of Old Testament Judaic symbolism. Well, when you find out from my work what Judaism is, that it came from the Druids, you see, we'll understand why these people think of themselves as the new priests and the new Druids. Like I said, they're all power drunk. Mm-hmm. It's easy to make these people drunk with power because not only do they have this knowledge, they have been conditioned to believe they're elites. They're special. Mm-hmm. Just like your bloody history teacher thought he was special and you were nothing. That same pompous arrogance that you find in the headmasters and teachers of ordinary schools, like they're some sort of set-apart nobility, these bloody punks who are misteaching you all this knowledge. So think further up the ladder, you know, beyond the lodge door. Mm. Just how utterly megalomaniacal these people are. People really know my work. They'll know the megalomaniac who started all of this, namely Akhenaten. Boy, oh boy, you don't get more, you know, solar possessed than that.
Yeah, yeah.
You literally, you're really in big time megalomania there. God almighty, it's incomprehensible. People need to read it to believe it, you know, how utterly insane. Well, if the top guy's mad, you know, everyone beneath isn't in such good state either.
That's right, that's right.
Oh yeah, and nobody's a Captain Kirk to stand up and go, question, what the hell is this all about? But this is what we're dealing with. We're dealing with pathology on a super scale. And you may hide in your little house, and you may hide behind the newspaper, and you may hide behind, you know, the consensus trance and the endless, you know, jabber that people talk about endlessly every day. You may hide away in that. You're hiding in the light. You're hiding away from these facts. And you may not know any of this. You know, and your neighbors may not know any of this because you don't want to know what is loose in the world. And you may say, well, I know the world's completely mad. That's why I don't want to think about it. It's like I read in that quote, you become party to the crime.
Mm.
If you won't occupy the white squares of knowledge, you have allowed that square to be occupied by those who will. And those people have the right then, the perfect right to manipulate you. I don't take that right away from them. If you don't occupy the square, don't blame them for occupying it and treating you like a pawn. You are the culprit. You are the miscreant. You have given your power away. Because there is no one on this earth that can take your power away unless you give it away. And this is that's a message right. that individuals need to learn in their personal relationships on a personal psychological level. And it's the next step up. It's a message that society needs to learn on a societal level. But the message is the same. The message is the same whether you take it down to the level of the personal relationship or the level of society, to the macro level.